today we're looking at this very interesting human being, a guy named Norman Bel Geddes. And he, of all the case studies we look at all semester, this is maybe my favorite human being. And he's someone who I've done a lot of research and work on. His archive, all of his papers, all of the documents of his life and his career are in the Humanities Research Center right next door. And when I was a young faculty member here, I discovered this crazy-ass guy, Norman Bel Geddes, and I was interested in him because he's just such a creative human being. And so I went over to the HRC and back in those days, they had just recently gotten his archive. He hadn't died that long ago. And so I said, I want access to this. And they said, well, we haven't got it all cataloged yet. And so it's going to be 5 years before people can get real access to this. So I said, damn it, that's not good enough. I want access to this. And so they said, okay, well, we'll just give you a pass and you can go up and all the stuff's just sitting there. It's not cataloged. It's just sitting in boxes and file cabinets and roller drawers and their models. There are all kinds of things. So I just spent weeks and weeks and weeks up there rifling through Norman Bel Geddes' life and got to the point where I really knew a lot about this guy. And wrote an article for a magazine it was a magazine about the future. And it was the 10th anniversary of this magazine, and they were doing a big thing on people who saw the future. And Norman Bel Geddes was one of the people they were interested in because I had been through all this stuff. They asked me to write the article. So I, boned up a little more on it. Wrote the article for this magazine, and part of what, in order to get the permission to use all the visual material, they asked me to go up and talk with his widow, who still had the copyright rights to all of those things, and she was kind of a notoriously difficult person, and the people at the magazine were afraid she wouldn't give them the rights, because I knew so much about her husband, I would have a better chance of getting her permission. So I went up and met his widow, and really she and I hit it off. We got to be buddies, and that was another entree to find out more about what was he like in a personal sense as well as what was he like in a professional sense. Just an absolutely fascinating human being and an incredibly, incredibly creative person. And what we're really going to be focused on today is what of these 10 terms were fueling his creativity, and what was it that made him capable of doing the kind of work he did? So this is the guy, Norman Bel Geddes. So I think this is not on play, but maybe we can get it on play. So Norman Bel Geddes was born in Adrian, Michigan, in 1893. This was just a small town, and he only went through the ninth grade. He actually got kicked out of school in the ninth grade. He always loved to draw, and he liked to draw cartoons, and he did a cartoon about one of his teachers, and it was extremely critical and devastating about this teacher. And it was so controversial and so devastating that they kicked him out of school for drawing this cartoon. And it actually made the newspapers. Nobody knows what that cartoon looked like. It hasn't ever surfaced. It's not in his archive over there. But he got kicked out of school, and they wrote it up in the newspaper. And then other newspapers picked it up, and it even got in the newspaper in New York City, that this kid got kicked out of school because he did this devastating cartoon that was so meaningful that they just couldn't let this kid stay in school. So a cartoonist in New York read that article And he contacted Norman Bel Geddes and he said, obviously you've got some capability here. I want to sponsor you to go to art school and really develop your skill. So he didn't, Norman Bel Geddes was from a pretty poor family. He didn't have the ability to go to art school, but this cartoonist in New York paid for him to go to Cleveland Art Institute, which is where that cartoonist had gotten his training. And so he went to Cleveland Art Institute and he got trained as a graphic artist. And then he got a commission from the Field Museum in Chicago. This is a museum of natural science, to go out to Indian areas in the Dakotas and to draw and document the life of these Indians in North and South Dakota, and for an exhibit that the Field Museum was doing. So this guy, he's like 19 years old, and he goes out to the Dakotas, and he gets all into Indians. Oh my God, he was just fascinated with Native Americans. And he makes these beautiful drawings that they use in an exhibit in the Field Museum. But he's just all over Native American culture. And then he goes back and he gets a little more training at the Art Institute of Chicago, moves to Chicago. And then while he's there, he gets some jobs as a graphic artist. And he's working for some printing companies. And they're doing, you know, this is in the era of mostly black and white print material. So he's doing ads and just stupid graphic kinds of things for them. But he starts experimenting around and thinking, you know, why are all these things in black and white? Why isn't it in color? It'd be much cooler to do this printing in color. And so he starts experimenting around with their printing presses in this printing firm he's working for. And he starts superimposing different colors of ink. And he realizes that if you by using four colors of ink and then superimposing them on top of each other, you can actually get a whole range of colors and make really good color reproduction. So this is back in the time when they're doing printing with ink on paper, and he would send it through the printing press several times, and we'd get these beautiful colored renditions. And he copyrighted his technology for how he would do that. And then they started doing color printing. And he, at age like 20, he's got this copyright that is making him tons of money because he figured out how to economically do color printing. And so he's this inventor. He's just a graphic artist. He's working for this company, this printing company. But he figures out this new technology of how to do this in color, gets a copyright, and then he starts making money. So now he's financially pretty stable at that point. Now he goes back to his Native American interest, and he wants to do something to explore this Native American thing. So he decides that he wants to write a play about Native Americans, and he wrote this play called Thunderbird, and he got it produced in Chicago, and it was kind of a hit, and people were really excited about it. And then he decided, you know, I'm not so much interested in graphic design and printing and all of that. I'm really interested in theater. So he decides, well, Chicago's not a really great center for theater, so instead I'm going to move out to Los Angeles. And he moves out to Los Angeles, and that's where they were doing film, and he was really excited about film. And he takes his Thunderbird production, and he does it out there. And then some people in LA get see this Thunderbird production. They get really excited about that. And so he begins to really get involved in theater. Out in LA, he marries this woman named Belle Schneider. They start collaborating and writing articles together. He's a great collaborator. He loves to interact with people. And Belle Schneider becomes his kind of partner in this. And then they get married. And they start working under the name Norman and Bel Geddes. His name is actually Norman Melanchthon Geddes. When he starts collaborating with Bel Schneider, they work under the name Norman Bel Geddes, her first name, his first name, and his last name. Now they're married, so it's their last name. And then they get divorced, and but he likes that name, Norman Bel Geddes, so he keeps the name Norman Bel Geddes, partly because they'd established some reputation with that name, and she's happy with that. And they keep collaborating to some extent even after they get divorced. They also had a daughter named Barbara Bel Geddes, and Barbara Bel Geddes was a major movie star. She, you know, they were in Los Angeles, and she's kind of grew up a little bit there, and she began to get some parts in Hollywood, and she became in the 1940s and 1950s a major movie star. And then probably you guys don't even remember the TV show Dallas, but this was a really big TV show in the 80s and 90s, and she was Miss Ellie, the sort of senior member of the family, the oil family in the TV series Dallas. So their daughter, his only child, ended up being this famous movie star. So he's in LA for a while and doing this theater thing. And in that period, he actually developed some technology for the theater that is really, really innovative. But then he decides, I'm not so interested in film, I'm much more interested in the stage, and so he moves to New York because that's where Broadway is, and he starts being a production designer, where he's designing the sets primarily for these big Broadway productions. Okay, for some reason these are just coming up as, these are supposed to come up in sequence, one of those at a time, but we'll just muddle through. It would be good if we could get the light out so we could maybe see that a little better. But so he's this production designer in New York. He begins to work with the very biggest directors on Broadway. And what he's doing is he's designing the sets. Number one, he invents the spotlight. Before this, there was no such thing as a spotlight. But he was into the lighting of these theatrical productions. And so he invents the spotlight. And it really was not that complicated. You just kind of put a pipe on a high-intensity bulb, and you concentrate the light. But nobody had ever done that before. In theatrical productions, they just lit the whole stage. But now he was about, I want to focus on this, and then focus on that. And the spotlight allowed that to happen. Again, he patented it, and he made a freaking fortune off the spotlight, because everybody else wanted to use it, and they had to pay him royalties on that. Then he also began to design these incredible sets. This is the peak of Broadway production. I mean, it is a really, really big thing, Broadway production. So he's being paid tons of money to redo these sets. And so for one production called The Miracle, which was about a religious event in medieval France, and it took place primarily in this Gothic cathedral. So his stage set was meant to be like a Gothic cathedral. But instead of doing that, he decided to hollow out the entire theater, take all the theater seats out, take everything out in the whole house of the theater, and recreate a Gothic cathedral inside the theater. So he made 80-foot tall stained glass windows all along the sides, lit from behind, so it was like light coming through the stained glass windows. The audience was seated in pews. They were inside the cathedral. So instead of all the action taking place on the stage, you were in the middle of the church as an audience member, and the action took place around you. Super innovative ideas about how to do theater. He, in that period, invented what's called theater in the round, where the audience is all the way around the stage. He again patented that. There got to be theaters all over the country in the 1950s that were theater in the round, and all of them, you know, had to pay that royalties back to that patent by Norman Bel Geddes. He got hired, there was a big World's Fair that was happening in Chicago in 1929, He got hired to design a theater for the World's Fair, and he designed an incredibly innovative theater, and that actually is it in one of those pictures up there. This is a, there it is. It's in, that's the theater. It was actually two theaters and a children's theater, all in a kind of complex like that. But the really innovative thing here was, instead of having a fly loft and all of the stage sets coming from above, he had them come from below, and they moved on these hydraulic systems that then came up in the middle of the stage. But everything he did as regards the theater was just incredibly innovative. And the reason why we have his collection here is because the Humanities Research Center, one of their real strengths is theater and film. They have probably the best collection in the United States of theater and film archives. So I'm sitting there studying Norman Bel Geddes, and I'm seeing these drawings and models and things he did. And right next to it is Scarlett O'Hara's dress from Gone with the Wind, because they have all of the costumes from Gone with the Wind in the HRC. And I'm in the theater collection because he's such a badass, you know, theater innovator. And so I just sat there by Scarlett's dress, you know, the whole time I'm researching his work. So super innovative in terms of theater. And then at a certain point, he kind of runs through these ideas in the theater. And he says, okay, now I'm interested in all kinds of accoutrements, you know, things for daily life. He actually decided that theater is a little vapid. I don't want to just deal with something that's a moment in someone's experience. They go to the theater for 2 hours. I want to deal with their everyday life, everything they touch and they do during their life. So he got very interested in these movements, these design movements in Europe. In particular, a guy named Eric Mendelssohn on the top left there. Eric Mendelssohn had designed the Einstein Pavilion, this thing right here, which was a very innovative architectural object. And it really had to do with Einstein and physics and this whole notion of not just gravity, but maybe a more fluid sense of how the universe works. And so this architecture, this more fluid architecture, had come out of Mendelssohn's interest in physics and in Einstein. And so Norman Bel Geddes is all over this idea. And he also is very interested in the Bauhaus, this design school in Germany, where they were designing everything. They were designing fabrics and fashion and teapots and furniture, and but it was just designing the world we lived in and redesigning how people lived in a modern world. So he gets totally into that. And out of that, he starts this studio in New York where it's basically, we design anything. If you got something that needs to be designed, we're going to do it. And he builds this company, and it gets up to about 40 employees. And they're designing anything. So he hires engineers, and he hires efficiency experts, and he hires business people. And he's very interested in the way things are manufactured and how efficiently they're manufactured. He's interested in getting the cost down so everybody can afford these new and innovative things, that they're not just for rich people, sort of IKEA before its day. So he starts this design company. And again, some of the key terms we're interested in, he's all over collaboration. So what he wants to do is, and this is a guy who has no college degree. You know, he went through the ninth grade, and he's hiring these PhDs from MIT and from Harvard to come in who know all the engineering and know the manufacturing processes. And so he's collaborating with them and bouncing ideas off of them. And then he's also hiring people who are, you know, experts at marketing and communications and how would we sell these products, and what, and doing market studies, really before market studies are much of a thing. He's out there doing polling and focus groups and trying to figure out what would there be a market for here. So it's kind of a consulting firm that he's hiring, and very, very successful there in New York City. Part of what he got into was homes and how can we transform American life. And this would have been in the late 1920s, early 1930s. And let me tell you a few stories here. So that stove on the left, imagine that every home in America at that time, they've got a cast iron stove. That was just everybody's house had a cast iron stove. They're black. They're made of this kind of soft iron that kind of absorbs things a little bit. And they were always up on feet, so they would sit in your kitchen, and they're sticking up on these feet, and then they would have your ovens, you know, the cooktop and the burners, and they were notoriously dirty. Cooking, you know, there's grease and there's things like that, and actually cast iron absorbs some of those, some of that grease, and it was notoriously hard to clean. And then there's all that area underneath your stove where it gets kind of mucky and dirty. I can like remember my grandparents having a cast iron stove, and it was roaches in there and spiders. I mean, just it was messy and dirty. And but that's how everybody had these cast iron stoves. And that was the only way to cook your dinner. And so this company that made stoves came to Norman Bel Geddes and said, we'd like for you to redesign a new stove for us. And they said, we'd like to do it in 10 days, and we'll give you $1,500, which in 1930, $1,500 was a lot of money. So maybe like 20,000 bucks these days. So, okay, we want you to do a 10-day little charrette, little study here, redesign this stove, and we'll give you essentially in our money $20,000, which sounds okay. But Norman Bel Geddes says, no way. What I want is a year. And I want to be able to study all your manufacturing processes. I want to study the market that's out there. I want to do a lot of interviews with housewives who are cooking in these areas. I want to totally understand what cooking is in America today. And I want to understand what kind of stove we need to progress into the future. And I want to understand how we can do it economically using your manufacturing methods so that everybody can afford a really cool, really much, much better stove. And I want an advance of $50,000 on the royalties. I want royalties on this. This guy was all over royalties. He did not want to get paid. He wanted to get a piece of the action for when they were selling these things. He'd get a few bucks on every stove they sold. So they did a little negotiation, and they ended up halfway in between. But out of that came his invention of the stove, which we're seeing on the left right there. And although, you know, this is maybe hard to conceive how innovative that was, but it completely transformed cooking. Number one, on the top, instead of those open burners, which were a little bit dangerous, but certainly dirty. I mean, you're not going to clean that every time, and so it just is mucky in there. But you can see that on that stove, there's a cover for all of that. So when you're not using the burners, it's covered up, and that gives you extra counter space. And then when you start to cook, you slide the top down, and that means that it stays clean. It doesn't collect dust and everything, and you're not constantly trying to do other things and spilling them in all those crevices that are around the cooktop. So completely different top to the thing. Then right below there were drawers, and that's where you keep your utensils, your spatulas, and the things you use for cooking. And then below that would be the ovens, the two ovens that are right there. And then in the bottom, instead of it sitting on legs and then having dirty area underneath, they're drawers, and that's where you have your pots and pans. So the pots and pans are right there and super handy for cooking, and everything's clean. And he makes it out of not cast iron, but porcelain-covered steel, which was sheet metal, The old stoves, when it got hot inside, it's just a layer of cast iron there, so it makes the kitchen extremely hot. It also loses heat through that wall, but instead he puts insulation around the interior of the oven, and then he puts the thin layer of steel with porcelain on it, and the porcelain is super easy to clean, completely impervious. It doesn't absorb anything. So he changes the material of the outside. He insulates the whole thing. Now you've got an instrument for cooking that is super clean, super convenient, doesn't generate a lot of heat in the kitchen, and it's just a huge improvement. And it sells like hotcakes. I mean, that thing was just so much better than any previous stove. Every household wanted to have that kind of stove. And even to this day, although, and that was done in 1933 or something like that, to this day, we haven't really changed ovens and stoves and all that much. They're still basically the same principles, the same. We even still use porcelain-covered steel. Sometimes we use stainless steel and other things too, but that technology of making a stove, it's still influential today. Again, then he gets a royalty out of that, and you know, it's that's how he's making a living. Now, another one of our 10 terms that's very germane here is optimism. I mean, these guys from this stove company walk into his consultancy and they say, we want you to reinvent a stove. Now, he could easily have said, oh shit, I don't know anything about stoves. I don't know anything about cooking. I don't know anything about manufacturing stoves. Probably I'm going to screw up here, and I don't want to look like an ass here. But instead, he was always optimistic. I can find a better solution for any problem you have. I know I can. I'm smart. And besides that, I've got my team here. You know, it's not just me. I'm a collaborative person. I've got a team, and I've got people who are engineers, and I've got people who really understand the manufacturing process, and I've got marketing people. And, you know, all of us as a team, we can absolutely solve your problem, no matter what problem you walk in the door with. He was optimistic about that. And that was fundamental in him building this company. On the right, that's a bed that they produced. Again, you got to think of in the 1930s, what did beds look like? They were these big, clunky, heavy wooden things. Think of four-poster beds and that's what every household had. But a lot of people were trying to live in New York in small apartments, and these beds were so big and so heavy and so clunky. So instead, he made this very streamlined, very kind of thin, lightweight bed that was, again, made of lacquered metal with chrome trim on it. So it was very, very bright, very sleek. And that was the first, in the history of product design, this was the first piece of product that had the label of the designer. This was the Norman Bel Geddes bed, and it was sold as the Norman Bel Geddes bed. And he began to have name recognition. He was a brand as an innovator. In the middle there is a little image of a house that he designed for Ladies Home Journal. Ladies Home Journal was like the big magazine that all housewives would have read in the 1930s and 1940s. And they said, show us what the living of the future is going to be and design a house that, lets us see how we could be living in the future. So he designs this house. And one of the things he was very interested in was how the car interfaced with the house. In the 1930s, they're just beginning to have every household have a car. Before that, it was unheard of. And so before having a car, you probably had a horse and some kind of cart or buggy or something, and that would have been kept in the backyard. You'd have a little barn back there, and maybe you'd have a driveway that went past your house to the barn in the back where the horse and the buggy were. But he's saying, okay, now we got cars. And people were parking their car back where their horse and their buggy were. You'd have a driveway down the side, and you'd have a parking spot, a garage in the back there. But he said, no, this is This is not the way we're going to live in the future. The car belongs to the street. Why would you take it to your backyard? You want to use that backyard for playing and barbecues and, you know, beautiful vistas out to trees and things like that. You don't want your damn garage and your car back there. So he puts the car on the front of the house. And I can't point with this, but you can see that circular form in the front. Well, that was an area where you drive right off the street and into your garage, and you would drive in, and there was a turntable in the garage so that it would rotate, and then you'd just press a button and it would rotate your car 180 degrees and you'd drive out so you wouldn't have to back out, because people were driving their car down their driveway and then they were backing out their driveway and they were having a hard time doing that. This is going to make it super easy. You just whip in off the street, it turns around 180 degrees on a turntable, and you just drive out forwards. Just in every way, he's thinking through, what can I do to make life better? That's that garage right there. You drive in here, the turntable would turn you around, and you drive right back out like that. Okay, so he's just thinking of anything. We can do better. We can be more creative. We can think of new solutions to any problem that came along. That interest in cars from the Ladies' Home Journal, he began to really start thinking about cars. Why are cars like they are? He began to think of aerodynamics and streamlining. Cars move through the air. If we're going to get, and at this point, cars are going like 30 or 40 miles an hour. That's tops. But he's imagining, no, cars are going to be going 100 miles an hour. And when they go fast like that, they're going to need to be aerodynamic. They don't want to have a lot of drag from the wind. So why are we making these stupid looking, and you know what Model Ts and all that looked like. Well, that's what the cars were like in the 30s and 40s. And he's saying, no. Let's make something that's much more sleek and streamlined. And then when it moves through the air, there's as little drag as possible on the car. So that car and that car, those were designed in 1933. And those look like, even today, that would be a badass, you know, wild design for a car. But to imagine that in 1933, it's pretty phenomenal. He was also interested in, you know, this little fin right there that would actually increase the aerodynamic efficiency of the car. He then began to think of cars that could also be airplanes. Why couldn't you have it so that you're driving on the road, and then if you want to, you can just take off and make it an airplane, and then the wings fold up and it becomes a car again. So he's thinking of every possibility of a car and what it can be in the future. And he gets hired by all these companies. So Chrysler had him design one of their cars in the 1940s. But mostly he's doing future visioning. But he's being hired by these car companies to think what the car of the future might be like. And then he gets hired by, and unfortunately it's all buried under these layers of things that are supposed to pop up one at a time. But he designs this airplane, and it was to be a transatlantic airplane. At that point in the 30s and 40s, this is before Lindbergh. I think Lindbergh flew across in the late 20s or something. But, you know, there's no mass transit across the Atlantic Ocean or across any ocean on an airplane. Airplanes flew short distances. But he designed an airliner that was a gull wing, which actually, when we got supersonic airplanes, 50 years later, they were gull wing design, where it's really just wings. It's not a fuselage with wings attached. The whole thing is just wings, so that the whole mechanism is doing the lift. So he did this gull wing airplane. It had a 528-foot wingspan. That's almost two football fields. It was 9 stories tall. It was designed to go across the Atlantic in 42 hours. It would have to stop. It would go from New York, stop in Newfoundland to refuel, and then go to London. and it would take 42 hours to make that trip. It was kind of the combination of an ocean liner, which was the way you went to Europe at that point, and an airplane. And it had, like 350 passengers and 150 staff that took care of them. It had a ballroom. It had tennis courts. It had a barber shop. So like an ocean liner, you could do anything in those 42 hours. It had sleeping quarters for everyone. You're not sitting in that damn little seat, but instead it's quite a comfortable place. But he imagined a transport vehicle that could go transatlantic. He also got hired by the ocean liner people. There you can see on the left this ocean liner that he designed in 1934. Now, you got to think what an ocean liner looked like in 1934. Nothing like that. It had big smokestacks and, you know, shaped like a boat. But he's thinking in hydrodynamics. How do we make this move through the water with the very least amount of drag and move through the air also with the least amount of drag? So these days, ocean liners kind of look like that. If you go on a big Disney cruise or something like that, it looks remarkably like that, much more hydrodynamic and aerodynamic. But it took 50 years for the industry to catch up to these visions that Norman Bel Geddes had way back in the 1930s. So in that case, he's shrouding the smokestacks so that they don't create drag as it moves through the air. All of the, there you can see back behind there, all the lifeboats pop out from the side. So when you need the lifeboats, they're not creating drag all the time. They're kind of concealed in, but then when you need them, they pop out and can be dropped down. Back in here, which you can see in this back picture, there's a sand beach there, but it's got a glass shelter on it so that you can go to the beach while you're on your ocean cruise. It also had tennis courts and other kind of recreation facilities out there, but these were movable glass walls. So now he's thinking the technology that eventually was there in these stadiums that can be indoor or outdoor. He's doing it there. He also invented the first indoor-outdoor stadium in the 1940s. So he's thinking through everything. He does this yacht for a very wealthy guy in New York, where he's, and that one is almost a football field long. That one was only for 13 passengers, but 30 crew members. So a very luxurious yacht. It had a two-car garage in there, so you parked your car in there and then took it to the next port of call, and then you'd hide your car that you could take out and drive around and then put it back in there. He's designing trains, but again, extremely streamlined. Didn't look like trains at the time, but these very sleek things that actually didn't go into large production until the Japanese invented their high-speed train, which now the bullet train looks remarkably like the train that Norman Bel Geddes designed in the 1930s. And he's designing these things all the way down to the fittings in the dining room. And a lot of them did get implemented, more the interiors things than the whole locomotive, but in the train industry. Okay, this guy is just inventing everything you can imagine. The Toledo Scale Company, which was a big company that, big manufacturing company in Toledo, Ohio. They asked him to design a whole new facility for them, manufacturing, offices, marketing, the entire company, whole new facility for them. And so he thought from scratch, what is a company? And how do you treat your employees? And what kind of environment should you create for this company that employed 1,500 people there in Toledo? And what he comes up with is remarkably like a Google campus or an Apple campus today, in that it was a place where you could have snacks and food all the time. There were places to work out, gyms and recreation places and tennis courts and It was like a country club kind of thing there. There was a car wash. There was a place to get your laundry done. So that it was that idea of mixing work and life instead of having a 9-to-5 job and then you got to figure out how to get everything else in your life taken care of outside it. It really is like these Google and Apple campuses now where the company is thinking of how do I make your life easier and how can you take care of some of those things here at your workplace. Then the Depression came in 1929 and they didn't build that campus, but it had a lot of ideas that were used later by other companies. He then starts getting interested in the way cities are put together. And he studies the work of Le Corbusier, who was making these proposals for European cities, the idea of these towers in a park, lots of green space in the middle of the city. He got hired by Shell Oil Company to imagine what the downtown of American cities would be like, especially with the impact of the car. The oil companies and the car companies were interested in how the car was going to change the way American cities were configured, and so he's hired to have this vision for what the future of the city is. Okay, so here's this guy, Norman Bel Geddes. He is all over at the beginning, printing techniques, printing presses, color printing. He makes a whole career worth of innovation there. He then moves into theater, and he gets very involved in spotlights and lighting techniques and theater in the round and production and even then design of how theaters are put together, how stage sets are changed, that sort of thing. He makes a whole innovation and career worth of impact in theater. And then he goes to the everyday home of Americans and he starts thinking about how you cook and how you sleep. And he starts designed everything inside the house, radios that became standard radios that everybody had in their house. He designed furniture, he designed, and then whole homes and ways your garage would work or how the car would interface with the home. Then he starts designing cars and transportation vehicles, ocean liners, airplanes, trains, and how those transportation systems would change and innovate, and then how they would impact the city and how the city might... this guy is all over the place. He's thinking of all of these creative ways you could improve life in America in the 1930s, 1920s, and 1930s. So I think this guy is what we might call a polymath. So a polymath is someone who has very broad interest and knowledge. A polymath is someone who has very broad interest and knowledge. He just can't focus himself on one thing he was going to become expert in. He was interested in everything. And I want us to have a little talk here about the idea of being a polymath. Now, I would say that part of why Norman Bel Geddes was so successful was because he used hybridization. We talked about hybridization in the Blanton Saturday. Very, very potent tool for creativity. But Norman Bel Geddes could be extremely effective in terms of hybridization because he had such broad interest and knowledge, because he was such a polymath. So that it was because he understood everyday life in the American home that he could think of how the car interfaces with that. It was because he understood cars and transportation and aerodynamics and that he could then look at an ocean liner and understand hydrodynamics and aerodynamics and how that works. And then from that, he could understand how you would design freeways and transportation systems and cities. And so one bit of knowledge informs a related discipline. And over and over and over, he uses a kind of domino effect to spark his creativity in whatever area he's asked to look at. So I want to talk a little bit about this notion of being a polymath. And actually here at UT, there is an organization called the Polymathic Society. Anybody heard of the Polymathic Society here at UT? No one. It's actually in the College of Natural Sciences, and they meet on Fridays at lunch. And the whole idea of that, it's organized by the College of Natural Science, and basically they're saying that if you want to be a good scientist, you need to be a polymath. It's very good to have this broad interest and knowledge. And so they have this organization. They give scholarships. The Polymathic Society gives scholarships. And I've spoken at their Friday seminar a couple of times. There are usually 40 or 50 people that show up at that. And these are people who say, if I'm going to be a scientist, I need to be a polymath. And so I want to be a part of the Polymathic Society. So I want to have a little discussion here whether or not you're interested in this notion of being a polymath. Is being a polymath a good thing? Or because I think in many ways the educational system these days does not say be a polymath. It says no, be a specialist, be focused. Don't have broad interest and knowledge. Focus your interest and knowledge on one thing and be an expert at that. That's exactly the opposite of Norman Bel Geddes. That's the opposite of what the Polymathic Society and the College of Natural Sciences advocates. I want to know what you think about that. What do you think about being a polymath? Does that sound interesting or does that sound silly? Yeah, what do you think?
So whenever I've heard about polymaths, they've mostly been like more like liberal arts than like natural sciences. So like Leonardo da Vinci or Benjamin Franklin. So it's like, I feel like a lot of times like creative people will just like have like a lot of like overlaps between like problem solving, like societal problems, as well as like engineering and stuff like that.
So Leonardo da Vinci is a classic polymath. At the very same time as he's engineering defense fortresses for medieval, Renaissance leaders in Italy, he's also designing a church, you know. So, yeah, they're all the same thing. They're all creative problem solving. So he was definitely a polymath, and he's doing inventions, and he's doing mechanical devices, and then at the same time, he's painting and doing depictions of the Last Supper. So that's a polymath. Yeah, what do you think?
I think it's a really good thing because I think it allows you to be more open-minded because it exposes you to several different points of view. And I think that helps as well because if you're more open-minded, you can speak to more people about more things, so it only helps you enhance your knowledge.
That's cool. So somebody else got a thought? Yeah. So what do you think about being a polymath?
I think it's really smart. I think it's always better to try to be a jack of all trades as opposed to risking being a master of none. And from the sounds of it, this guy wasn't necessarily great at any one thing, but he has such a diverse portfolio that he still managed to go on to become, you know, really well known and really successful.
So, and I think part of what he also knew was that as a polymath, I need a team. So then when I start to really drill down and solve that problem, I probably do need that engineer or I need that marketing person, or so it wasn't like he excluded other kinds of, he wasn't trying to do everything himself. But as a polymath, he could see things that engineer couldn't see, or that marketing person couldn't see, because he saw the bigger picture. Yeah. So what do you think?
I think that being a polymath is definitely something that we could all become, because it's so helpful in life. But I also feel the education system here is not really geared towards that. Mm-hmm. I know that there are some colleges that don't let you decide their major, your major, till like the second year, versus here where you have to pick your major coming in sometimes. Mm-hmm. So that kind of makes you very focused on your major or just your degree rather than doing things that you actually enjoy and looking into more things.
I think that's a good point. Yeah, what do you think?
I read an article about like the top 100 scientists, and it was talking about how they throughout like their first 100 papers that they published, that on average they switched subjects or like research topics like 40 times. And so I think that just goes to show that like if you diversify what you're doing, you can get like grab inspiration from all those different things and help you, like it helps you become successful.
Excellent point. Yeah, what do you think?
I think being interested in everything is really important, especially because it kind of helps you with failure. Because if you're laser focused on only one topic, then if you fail in that area, then I guess it's over. But if you're kind of a polymath and you're interested in everything, it gives you the freedom mentally to move on and say, I can go back to that later and be successful in something else, rather than saying, I messed up, this is it.
Very cool. Yeah, what do you think?
I think the idea is important just because, like, being a polymath, the more you learn, the more you're able to connect everything with each other. And I think that's kind of what he did, because the more you learn, like, the more you're able to use the knowledge you learned in one area in another, and that allows you to be an innovator.
And that's just this notion of hybridization, that you're constantly, if you know about this and you know about this, there's a temptation to think, well, how could that connect? Whereas if you don't know about it, it's very hard to imagine effective hybridization, because you're not knowledgeable enough to really bring those things together. So if you're going to do hybridization, you almost have to be some degree of a polymath. You have to have multiple or broader interests or knowledge. Yeah, what do you think?
I think being a polymath is extremely useful because it gives you a more diverse outlook on life, but also going back to the point of being able to see what engineers and other people are not able to see, you can also see what they're able to see. Therefore, you're able to delegate more tasks efficiently and work around problems through their point of view too.
The other thing I think that's characteristic of polymaths is that they thrive on working with teams like that. And now this is not so much collaboration, this is teamwork. I'm working with someone who knows something I don't know, who has a capability I don't have. And a polymath is interested in, what are you doing as an engineer? I'm not an engineer, but I'm fascinated by what you do. So when I work with you on a team, some of that rubs off, and I get some of that knowledge, and then I take that to the next instance. And the cumulative effect over a career is phenomenal, just breadth of knowledge. If you combine teamwork and hybridization, whoa, that can mean in a long career, you become capable of a great deal. And that's very different than, let's say, you just did the same thing over and over and over through your whole career. I heard someone describe one time that they interviewed two people for a job, and both of them had been out of school 20 years. And this guy described this one guy had 20 years of experience. Every single year was different. He did new things. He explored new things. He had 20 years of experience. This other guy had the same year 20 times. That all he'd done is the same thing he did the first year. He did it the second, the third, the fourth. And he had 1 year of experience, but he had it 20 times. So are you building a career where you have 20 years of experience, 30 years of experience, really changing and growing all of that time? Or do you just have 1 year of experience that you repeated over and over? So I want to talk about, we're going to get back to Norman Bel Geddes in a minute, but someone like Steve Jobs, he's the classic polymath. So in school, what he's the most interested in is calligraphy. That's he's all over type fonts and graphic design. That's really what he was intensely interested in college. And then he gets kind of interested in computers after he gets out, and he runs into other people in California who are into that, and he gets super involved in that, and he builds Apple computers and, you know, builds it to a point where it's a very successful company. And then he gets fired from Apple because he's so pushy and difficult and all of that. But then when he gets fired from Apple, he goes to Pixar. And he takes a company that makes animated films. And he makes Pixar the go-to place. Disney had always been the go-to place for animated films. Now he builds Pixar into the go-to place for animated films and completely innovates the way animated films are done and produced. And then he goes back to Apple and reinvents that company all over again. But, you know, Steve Jobs, he's not just a computer guy. He's a polymath who applied it in many different ways. Had a student here, really, really great student. His name was Saheb Subharwal. His family was from Kuwait. He was Sikh and Indian descent. And he came here as an architecture student. He studied architecture here, got his bachelor's degree in architecture. But then he went to work for Anderson Consulting, which what Anderson Consulting does is it takes people and it sends them out to a company and they are brainstorming to try to solve a problem with that company. They're a consulting company. And he had 3 years of fantastic experience traveling all over the world just solving these business problems. But he was using his skills as an architect, which is about creative problem solving, and his ability to have design thinking, but applying it to business kinds of problems. Then he went back to Stanford, went to business school, got an MBA, and just recently, last year, he was named on Fortune Magazine, which is a business magazine. They had 40 under 40, the top 40 business people under 40 years old. And there's Saheb Subharwal as one of those people. You know, he didn't major in business as an undergraduate. His job at Anderson Consulting wasn't based on having business skills. It was based on having very diverse, broad knowledge. And that's really what catapulted him into very early in his career having this this success and distinction. Okay, so I just want to wrap up on Norman Bel Geddes. He then went on to design what was one of the most influential acts of the 20th century, which was the General Motors Pavilion at the 1939 World's Fair in New York. General Motors had the prize location at the 1939 World's Fair. This was in a day when the World's Fairs were the way that ideas were communicated through the whole world. So, you know, this was a 7-acre plot that General Motors had right next to the center of the fair, the Triglyphs and Pyrosphere. So that was the General Motors Pavilion. And they hired Norman Bel Geddes. They basically said, unlimited budget, just knock everybody on their ass and show what the future is going to be as regards cars, because that's what their business was. So he invents this pavilion where 25 million visitors went there. It was by far the most popular pavilion at the fair. And there were just constant lines snaking up here, trying to get into the pavilion. When you walked in the front door, the very first thing you saw was a huge map that was 80 feet tall on the wall, and it showed an interstate highway system. Prior to that, all highways, all roadways were done by states in the United States. And you'd come to the border between Oklahoma and Texas, and the roads didn't even meet up. But certainly there was no sort of big thinking about how you would go across the country. And it meant that we weren't able to transport goods across the country. And commerce was greatly deterred by the fact that you just couldn't move goods across the country. And so he had this image that showed an interstate highway system where you connected all of the United States via this highway system. And that's where you waited, and then you waited a while, and then you got onto this little conveyor belt. It was actually, he invented it consulting with Westinghouse and Otis Elevators. And it was a moving thing that moved both up and along on a conveyor belt. And it had all these little booths for two people each, and they were lined in beautiful blue mohair. So it seemed like a sort of theater seat here. It had the first stereo system that had ever been done, where the sound came from two sides rather than from one speaker source. It had to be very carefully tuned so that each person is hearing a slightly different message, because as they're moving along, they're looking onto this huge model of the future of America. It was 3/4 acre model, and it was various different scales. So it would show the scale of a whole region, and then it would focus in on a town, and then it would focus in on an intersection. And so it was all these different scales of models, and it was showing you what America would be. And the light would go down and it would come up and you'd be in a different environment. And but it was this 18-minute ride through what the future would be in America. There were 500,000 buildings, 500,000 buildings that they produced. There were 1 million trees of 18 different species. There were 50,000 cars, 25,000 of them moved through this model. It was built by 106 workers who worked more than a year to build the thing. It was built in 408 panels that were about 6 feet by 10 feet, and they were all assembled later together. It was this mammoth effort to imagine what the future would be, and then to create the technology of experiencing that as you went through this little storytelling of what the future would be. And it basically was a future that talked about cars, that now we can travel across America, now we can go on these vacations, now we can go out from the city into the countryside and get refreshed. The car liberates us. It allows us to be independent human beings. And it showed a complete transformation of the city, where you would have the pedestrian traffic separate from the car traffic down below. And then you went through this whole model, and eventually you would end up where you're looking at this intersection in a model like that, and then you step out of it and suddenly you're actually in the city. And you're in, and a portion of that whole building was the intersection of these four buildings. In there you can see 1, 2, 3, 4, and there's an intersection in between. So you see it in the model, and then you walk out and you're in that space in reality. And one of the buildings on the corner is a GM showroom, and you can see the latest cars. One is a department store where Frigidaire had all their appliances on display. One of them was a science theater where you could go in and hear a lecture on the technology that would produce this new city. It was a badass, amazing experience. 25 million people went there. One of them was Walt Disney, who was totally blown away by it. And eventually he did Disneyland based on the GM Pavilion at the World's Fair. And still to this day, when you go to Disneyland or Disney World, all those little, you know, vehicles with, you know, that play music and wind you through some ride, that all came from the 1939 World's Fair and Norman Belgetti's design for that. And Disney was overt about saying, yeah, it all came from there. It also, that model making technique really inspired Hollywood and a whole generation of Hollywood films that were shot from models, so that you could imagine, especially science fiction films, because they couldn't recreate a set for all that. But you can, his model making technique allowed them to make very realistic models that then they could shoot and make parts of movies. The Interstate Highway Act of 1944 really came because Franklin Roosevelt went to the GM Pavilion at the 1939 World's Fair. He was president at the time. He then asked for a meeting with Norman Belgetti. Norman Belgetti goes in and talks to the president about his vision for an interstate highway system, and that began to get into legislation. And now the interstate highway system we have that links together the whole United States, where would we be without IH-35, IH-10, IH-45? I mean, all these things that connect the country together. Enormous influence this guy had. Okay, Twitter card.